Okay, since we have no microphone, I will speak standing so that everybody can hear me. My name is George Yagaba, and my topic will be the church-state relationship. My topic will certainly be mainly focusing on the church relationship, but I'll relate to the church mainly on the Catholic Church, but not exclusively. When Pope John XXIII opened the Second Vatican Council, he said he wanted to bring the church into the world. And since that time, the church has always been referring itself in two ways, either as the people of God and as the church in modern time. The church as the people of God and modern time, it means that the joys and hopes, the griefs and anguish of the people are the same for the church. That the church feels with the people, journeys with them in all aspects of life. And the people of God doesn't necessarily mean the Catholic Church. It means all the people of God, irrespective of who they are. It is no longer that without or outside the Catholic Church there is no salvation. The Church believes, the Catholic Church believes the Church is too wide. It involves all people of God. So since that time, the Catholic Church has always been concerned in the affairs of the Church. One theologian by the name of Ted Fielding, he makes the comment, I quote, "There is little purpose in reading the scripture as a living address to our lives if we are continually warding off the signs of the time that constantly resound with its address. Against our propensity to fall asleep in the drowsy or calmness of our selfishness, we are urged to stay awake, lest we perceive but do not perceive, hear but do not hear." So what Terry is telling us, the church must be involved in the affairs of the world, reading the signs of the time. I move to another question. What was Jesus' attitude to the towards politics? Long before the birth of Jesus Christ, Israel had been looking for the liberation of Jerusalem from the Roman oppression. So they were looking for a liberator, and this liberator was not necessarily a religious liberator, because at that time the issues concerning the state and the church and the region were almost the same. So as we read from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 24, when the apostles went to Emmaus, disillusioned, met Jesus Christ, they made expression, I quote, "We are hoping that he would be the one to redeem Israel." So their hope in Jesus Christ was that he would be the liberator who would set the people free. Jesus himself, in what I call his manifesto, in chapter 4 of Luke, verse 18 to 19, he said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. God has sent me to set the prisoners free and proclaim the year of liberty." So Jesus Christ says that he comes as a liberator. The kingdom of God, which Jesus Christ came to preach about, is a kingdom that accepts or does not accept the oppression to the kingdom, that where it is, the poor are set free, the eyes of the blind are able to see. So it's the kingdom where there is liberty and freedom. And that is what Jesus Christ expressed. Certainly, Jesus Christ did not involve in politics like the Xerox. The Xerox wanted to bring change through manpower. But for Jesus Christ brought a change that we call metanoia, the change of heart. According to Jesus Christ, it was the lack of compassion that made people be slaves and be oppressed. So he says, if you bring compassion, it is the compassion that can change, the change of heart, the compassion with the poor, the compassion with the marginalized, would be the tool that could bring change. And that is what Jesus Christ was implementing, that is the method he used to bring change. Therefore I say, probably if Jesus is the apostles and the church had followed the method of Jesus Christ, the questions and contentions we have, the church relationship, maybe not be there. Because we see Jesus Christ never had conflict with the people of his time, the leaders, except at one occasion when Herod was trying to intervene in his mission. That is when Jesus Christ seemed to have lost his temper and referred Herod as a fox. But in most cases, he never had any complaint or problem with the Sanhedrin, except those who tried to marginalize other people. So I come to the question, if Jesus Christ set a goal, what went wrong? I look at what went wrong in focusing on two events. One is the conversion of Constantine to become a Christian in the fourth century, and the other one will be the theory of Marcionism. The conversion of Constantine to Christianity brought change into the understanding of the church and relationship. It is assumed that Constantine became a Christian, not necessarily was convinced of Christianity, but he wanted to use Christianity to stabilize his political method, to achieve his political goals. So when Constantine became a Christian, he assumed the role of the church, so much that at one time was referred to as God's lieutenant or God's messenger. He started getting involved into the church affairs, like appointing bishops and exposing them if they didn't agree, making decisions on doctrinal issues. And bad enough, on the part of the church too started making theoretical statements in favor of Constantine. So Constantine's involvement in the church brought a lot of change in the way the church looked at itself and the way it looked at the state. At one time, this raised kind of questions. Among those who raised questions was St. Ambrose, who argued that the church should stay aloof from such state affairs. He questioned the authority of the emperor into the church's affair. Hence, I think we have the question, what has Jerusalem to do with Athens? The church should always remain aloof, all the state should always remain aloof in what affairs affect the church. I look at it, this did not end with Constantine. It has even followed where the church has gone. As we have heard from different speakers, especially in African speakers, in Africa, the church, the leaders have used the church for their purposes. You find that many crook leaders, dictators, have entered into the circles of the church by bribing church leaders, either to be quiet from criticizing them, or even to gain votes. They go and fundraise for the churches. So it has always followed the church. So much that church leaders, state leaders, have entered into church circles to achieve their own political means. The second change or event I mentioned was the Manichaeism. Mani was one of the Babylonians who reigned during from the 216. They fight as a heresy, but it was kind of a philosophical religious group that followed Platonic methodology of dividing the world into two principles, the high principle and the lower principle. So according to Manichaeism, the world has two forces, the spiritual force and the material force. And human beings are in that category that we are imprisoned into the material force. Therefore, the salvation according to Manichaeism would be to set the soul free from imprisonment of the body. In other words, material thing or material world is an evil world. And if we can avoid it, so much the better. How did Manichaeism influence Christianity? St. Augustine, who became a great theologian and philosopher in the Catholic Church, was at one time a member of Manichaeism. And this influenced so much St. Augustine. When you read St. Augustine's attitude towards sexuality and marriage, you can see that he had that kind of attitude, making a separation between what is sacred and what is evil. Secondly, St. Augustine, he wrote what he calls the city of God and the city of the world. He made these two divisions of the cities. The city of God, which the church stands for, the city of holy people, men and women who are holy. And then the secular city, as that term comes, the city of those who are not holy. Therefore, this theory comes in the church to make Christians think that they are ideal. They are much better than the worldly, or they shouldn't interfere in the worldly affairs. This brought change in the church in two ways. Firstly, there are those who think that being in the church, The one influence was that there are those who thought that getting involved into the state affairs is being too associating with the profane, with things which are not sacred. Therefore, the more you are religious, the more you should associate yourself with the state affairs. And this has influenced the church even in Africa. Where I come from, Uganda, for example, in 1950s and 60s, the Catholics were told never to be involved in state affairs. Be in nursing, be in teaching profession, don't go into other public offices. That is why we had the first Catholic, Chief Magistrate Ben Chwanka, who was killed by Idi Amin. Is hailed not because he was the chief magistrate, but he was the first Catholic to be in public circles. Even now in Uganda, politics has followed that trend. There has never been a Catholic president. They are all coming, the presidents come from the Anglican Church, because the Catholics, from the beginning, their foundation was so poor, so much that even now they are not strong enough to make their way forward. And that comes from the understanding that the church... Let me go to where I feel the church should be able to involve itself in state affairs. The church has done enough, and the Lord, for example, building schools, hospitals, orphanages, but I feel the church should do much more. Where do I feel the church can work in relation with the state to build a strong society? One is the family life. I feel the family life, all marriages and family, need more support. Today, the families are faced with the problem of demography. There is in Africa the problem of overpopulation. I think the church needs to be involved in helping people to understand being responsible parents. But in this, the church shouldn't tell them about the method they should use, whether it's a natural planning or using contraceptives. The church needs to build the conscience and form the character of the people so that people can make their own decisions. The church, the communities for families are faced with the problem of poverty, and it is poverty that is making a lot of migration. So the church has resources like land, manpower. I think the church can contribute a lot to change the life of the people and as far as the economy is concerned and helping the families. The second aspect is the culture. Culture is part of our life, and culture influences political participation and economy. The church has tried to promote culture by incorporation, but I think the church needs to do much. Although the church has warned us also about the infestation of other cultures, saying that Africans must not embrace any culture, they need to be able to make a dialogue between cultures, African cultures and other cultures. The third element I look at is ecology and the environment. The church has done enough. For example, I think the Vatican in 2008, they installed the biggest panel at the Vatican to generate power. And that is the sign that the church is trying to promote environment. The South African bishops have talked about environment and genetically modified crops. Those are some of the areas the church has tried to mention, but I think there is still much more that we need to do. The last aspect is about biotechnology and bioethics. Biotechnology is a great change in our society, it's a great invention and great power, but I think it needs guidance, spiritual guidance and theoretical guidance. My argument is, technology gives us power, but it doesn't give us morals of how to use that power. So as much as technology comes in, I think we need the church guidance to give us the principles, for example, the principle of human dignity, the principle of solidarity, the common good. Those are some of the areas where I think the church can be able to guide the modern biotechnology so that our technology can serve the common good and save the life of all.